Quick warning before we get into the celebrations. There can be some swear words and adult concepts in these episodes, so make sure there's no kids around and maybe pop on some headphones. Rights for Women would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land upon which this podcast is recorded throughout Australia. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture. We recognise that sovereignty has never been ceded and pay respects to elders past, present and emerging.
Welcome to the Rights for Women Book Launch Podcast. I'm Pamela Cook, author, podcaster, and writing coach and mentor. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is a story about an orphan child, a lifelong friendship, and an impossible promise, now available at online retailers and through my website at pamelacook.com.au.
And I'm Kel from Rights for Women, the other half. I'm a podcaster and wannabe author. My business is Listen Up Podcasting, and we make podcasts for a positive world, like this one. You can find me at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or catch me on Facebook or Twitter.
As many of you will know, with the advent of coronavirus and lockdowns, authors with new releases have been unable to promote their books at live events. Here at Rights for Women, we want to help authors celebrate their new releases and help readers discover new books, all of which are available online, at retailers and through independent bookstores. We'll be releasing these mini-sode chats with authors regularly throughout the coming months while we're all in isolation and authors need a place to launch their books.
Please share the love by letting your reading friends know about the podcast and the books on social media and by reviewing any books you read to help authors get the word out. This is a great time to put some new books on your shelf, virtual and physical, and to share the gift of reading.
Hi, I'm Sally Bradfield, and I've recently published my novel, Not Quite 30 Love. And I'd like to read you a little excerpt from that. Flaccid, a word that strikes fear into the hearts of men, more than famine, war, or pestilence, more than the words, there's no more beer, do you want to talk, or where's our relationship going? Flaccid is how I made former Australian tennis hero Peter Fallon feel as he sat next to me in the Wimbledon president's box. Do you come here often? Said Mr. Fallon. No, I mean never. This is my first time. A virgin. You don't meet them often. He nudged a little too hard, his grin illuminating teeth bleached to offset his leather-tanned face. Would you like someone to show you around? Are you serious? That would be amazing. After the match, let me show you how it feels to be a player. He put his hand on my thigh. Technically, it was still my thigh, my upper thigh. I wished I was wearing my new trouser suit instead of a flimsy sundress. I used to love watching you play when I was a kid. Didn't mean to say it like that. Not like that anyway, it just came out. Not the best thing to say to a man in his late 40s who sees himself as virile and attractive while failing to notice the deepening crow's feet and lines, an inevitable reminder of glory days playing tennis in the unforgiving sun. As we watched the fuzzy yellow ball get smacked across the net, we sat in silence, except for the ever so slight squeak of his ego deflating. I felt a little uncomfortable, not as bad as feeling flaccid. Around us, 12,000 spectators had paid and queued to be seated on the centre court. Instead of billboards and banners, there were beds of flowers. Instead of rock music pumping between points, there were the titters of polite conversation and the clinking of Pimm's cups. I clutched my golden ticket into Willie Wimbledon's chocolate factory. While other kids had been conjuring images of chocolate rivers, I had envisaged heroes dressed in white, swinging rackets and playing long days of world's best tennis in the classic English summer. If Wimbledon is the chocolate factory, the President's Suite is the nerve centre. It faces the royal box where the Duke and Duchess of Kent sit in all their royal glory. The box is where the deal makers sit, tournament directors, their guests holding court, deciding who plays where and who gets what. Unlike the chocolate room, however, nothing is gratis. The strawberries and cream cost £10. That's $20 for three strawberries and a drizzle of cream. If it wasn't for Brexit, the conversion would have been worse. The seats are money can't buy experience. Less than 50 recipients at a time can sit on the cushions provided. The box was full and there was a continuous queue outside. They waited and hoped for someone to vacate a seat. The seats were situated directly behind the court, at the perfect height to watch the action. not to mention guaranteed TV exposure for the seated guests. Two spots along was a British morning TV host. One down and one across was a VJ. Many other faces were hard to pinpoint. It was like looking at your kindergarten class picture. I know her. I know her. How do I know her? The plethora of this season's Dior, Chanel, Louis Vuitton and Longchamp bags were recognisable as I kicked my unbranded drawers tote under the seat. After a full session sitting in the box yesterday, too scared to move in case I ended up back in the queue, my Facebook was full of likes and comments. My cheeky selfies with an accidental celebrity in the background had been the most popular. My new Instagram account, at NotQuite30Love, was also gaining traction. Maybe Jen had been right. I had taken a selfie with Peter Fallon earlier today. How do I tag that? Hashtag former glory. My parents had spotted me on TV. Mum had emailed approval at my outfit of choice. I'd worn a pretty blue and white sundress, nice navy shoes and an oversized Prada sunglasses. Copies, of course. I still couldn't believe I was here. I didn't want to do anything as cliched as pinch myself, but ouch. Exactly 12 months ago, I'd been sitting at home in my flat in Bondi watching Wimby on TV, agonising about what to do with my career. And it was only 4 weeks ago that I had left Sydney in search of a new life. Now I was sitting next to Mr. Fallon, courtesy of my new boss in New Haven. The seat was mine. Time to get the handbag to match.
I love it. You get a real sense of the atmosphere there. And is that the opening, Sally?
Sorry?
Is that the opening of the book?
It's not. It's about the third chapter. We go forward and backwards in time a little bit. She opens with a big crisis that she's created.
Fantastic.
And we find out how she got.
Well, based on what I've read in your bio, you are very well acquainted, shall we say, with the tennis world. Could you tell us a little bit about that part of your career?
Sure. So I started 1996 was my first year working in tennis, and I finagled my way onto the World Tennis Tour basically by berating and harassing and begging and all that sort of stuff, and got in to be a communications manager eventually with the Women's Tennis Association and with the Men's Tennis Association. So I spent about 15 years travelling with all of the top players and doing their public relations and all of that sort of wonderful stuff, and getting to know the ins and outs of the tour. So
fantastic. So were you a tennis tragic prior to that, and that's what encouraged you to do it?
I was. I remember sitting up late one night a couple of years before I got into tennis, thinking I was, you know, the stalled career. I was pretty young to have a stalled career, but I thought, oh, stalled career, what am I going to do? You know, I had my marketing degree, but I wasn't happy. I was bored. And I was watching Wimbledon late at night, obviously, because it's, you know, the Australian time difference. Yeah. I'm not interested in anything. I don't care about anything. And then suddenly I'm like, could you work in this? Could I work in tennis? And I just assumed initially it was going to be only, you know, former players that got jobs in tennis and people like that. But where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah, I love it. Such determination. So how did that then morph into writing and writing a book about, I guess, I'm guessing based on partly on your experiences?
Yeah, I think, I left the tour because I couldn't stand travelling anymore. My partner and I settled down, and she's a former tennis player. So we settled down in Sydney, and this would be about 10 years ago. And I wanted to write the book, and I, you know, like all things, you know, I'm going to write a book was the statement. And then the reality sort of became a bit like, I don't know how to write this book. And I ended up doing a master's in writing at UTS.
Fantastic.
That started the pathway to it, and I often joke that the first go at it, or certainly the first few chapters of the first time, was a thinly veiled Sally Bradfield's life, way too close to reality, and way more likely to get me sued and all that stuff. Slowly as I wrote on, you know, it morphed into being, you know, Katie Cook, who's the protagonist, but it became her story rather than my story. And the good news is I've still got all the early drafts, so if I want to write my autobiography down the track.
Yay. Yeah. Well, can you tell us about the storyline for the book and about Katie, your main character?
Absolutely. So Katie, it's set in the current day, which obviously changes from my experience. So Katie Cook lives in Bondi Beach. Sick of a life in Sydney, wants a bit more adventure, hasn't got a boyfriend, thinks the whole world's like a bit for her. And like me, I suppose, is a bit of a tennis tragic and decides to try and get on the tennis tour. And she does. Otherwise, it'd be a very boring story or a very short story. she creates an ill-fated Instagram post, and that's sort of where the book ends, where she does something that shouldn't be terribly stupid, but it coincides with a big event in society, and she gets caught up, and all the whole tour gets embroiled in her disaster of her making, and then off it goes, and we get to find out, you know, who she is and where she stands for and all that sort of stuff. And along the way, she meets and falls in love with a Russian tennis player who is absolutely not the best decision of her career. He becomes, you know, a big bit of trouble for her at the same time as being very exciting for her. So we get to see tour, we get to see how players live, we get to see how Katie stuffs up and how Katie fixes what she stuffs up. And, you know, it's a coming of age, I suppose, story, although she's not quite 30, she's 28 in the book. That's hence the title. So we get to see all her foibles, you know, becoming a person of her own nature.
Sounds wonderful. Would you describe it as a rom-com? What sort of genre would you say it would fit in?
Look, it is a rom-com, but it isn't a rom-com in the sense of boy gets girl gets boy, girl wins boy. It all ends up being about the boy. It certainly, boy is in there, romance is in there, but it's about the girl.
Excellent.
Who becomes a woman.
So I'm really curious, when you said you enrolled in the Masters, was your intention to write this particular book as part of doing that?
I mean, yes, it was certainly part of it. I want to write a book and I'm going to write a book about tennis, and I had some very vague ideas and I needed help on how to do that. I mean, being in marketing and public relations, I'd written what we call creative nonfiction for a very long time. And, you know, wanted to understand how to write fiction more clearly, how to drive a narrative over a much longer length, because obviously in marketing you're writing very short sales pieces, I suppose, for want of a better term.
Yeah.
And narrative is very, you know, very quick and very, you've got to get to the point very quickly and turn it around and finish it and, you know, end and move on to the next narrative. So to stretch something out and make it into a full book was something that I didn't really know how to do.
Mm.
Masters helped.
Yeah. And how much, so you said initially it was sort of more of a memoir, I guess. How did you, what were sort of the key things that you learnt about fictionalising, you know, those real events that you were using from your own life?
I think one of the key things I learnt was that you have to put the character in lots of situations that you're not going to necessarily put in the book to understand who the character is, how this character will react in this pressure situation and that situation. And then the character starts to tell you the story. Katie Cook, one of the things that helped me a lot actually, and it was post-Masters, but I'd written the first draft of the book, or probably the second draft of the book, and it was set around my time, so early 2000s. And I considered it a current day tale, but of course it's not a current day tale.
Right.
And I was pitching the book, and one of the people I was pitching to, who was a young publisher, said to me, it needs to be set today, it needs to be set with social media, it needs to have all of that in it. And, you know, I was actually in Sydney at the Writers' Centre and I'm driving back to the mountain, so 90-minute drive up the hill on a Friday afternoon thinking, oh, my God, I've got to rewrite the book. I said a few words. I had a couple of tears run down the cheek, like, oh, my God, I've got to start again. But it was really good. It's a really good suggestion. But also what happened is because I had to write her again in 2009 to 20, whatever, she couldn't be me. So any vestiges of me disappeared, and Katie even more became her own person. And, you know, putting her in those settings and writing a scene, and that's what was said to me in my master's once, write a scene where she's, you know, in the street and has a confrontation with someone just to find out who she is and what she'd do. And that sort of thing I found really helped find out who Katie was. And, you know, then she's off doing stuff and I'm like, oh, I was actually typing a few times going, oh, don't do that.
I know. I love it how they take on a mind of their own.
Exactly. Like a naughty child.
Yeah. So, and of course, putting it more into a contemporary setting would mean that you have to change the technology too, because, of course, even 15 years ago, the technology was completely different. And yeah, based on, you know, what you read out with the Instagram stuff, I'm guessing that plays a key role in the plot.
Absolutely. So social media obviously is critical. That's what springboards the whole crisis at the start, a social media gaffe, and it sort of pushes the story along as they go through. So everything they do is obviously chronicled on social media. Everyone has their accounts and, you know, everything that is real or not real, which is obviously very much the story of today, isn't it, is chronicled through social media. So, the understanding all of that. So it really did make the book change. Apart from obviously having to insert crisis here, it changed the trajectory of the book a lot. So,
yeah, for sure. And so once you'd sort of got to the point where you spruced it up and brought it into the 2020s and all that sort of thing, how did you go about finding a publisher for the book?
Well, I actually self-published.
Okay.
I did that because I believe I made some mistakes along the way, which I'm really happy to tell people about. And it wasn't ready, so it wasn't good enough. You know, the narrative was clunky in some places. There's so much competition for books, as God, you know. And, you know, if they don't get grabbed straight away or whatever, or they feel it gets clunky, they're sometimes just not sure, you know, is this going to float? What's going to happen with this? Is it too hard? I can put it in the too hard pile. And you can't keep going back to the same thing. And book. They've moved on.
Yeah. So were you pitching it sort of face-to-face sessions or were you submitting?
Yeah, and they always liked the pitch. So there was never a problem with the pitch. The problem was with the product. The product wasn't ready. So, and that was probably my problem too, because I'm a marketer. I'm good at the pitch.
You've got all that experience, yeah.
But the book wasn't ready and I didn't believe it. And, it's the first book sort of learning curve. And I could have just thought, I'm actually, you know, into a couple of drafts of my next book, but I believe that I know now how to pitch correctly and would get it through a publisher. And some people said, I'll just wait and they'll back pick the other book up. But the problem was I had written that book very current, the Not Quite 30 Love, and I was like, no, 5 years from now I'll be rewriting the whole thing again. And I was like, I just want this to happen. I feel like it's a story and it needs to be out there, and I don't really care if it doesn't make me a fortune. I just want it to get out there and see what people think. And luckily I've given it to quite a few tennis people and all of them, you know, have that really worried look on their face thinking, oh God, this is going to be really, really upsetting. And then they come back to me and they go, oh, I loved it.
Oh, fantastic.
So that's been the great part of it. I have got lots of positive feedback and I think it's just going to be the book that hopefully as many people who can find out about it read and hopefully enjoy. And, you know, the next book hopefully will have a different trajectory. But having what we've had now with COVID, how can you not talk about COVID?
Absolutely.
Is completely changed. So it really would have been impossible not to have completely rewritten this book. So I don't regret my decision to self-publish. I regret being quick enough that I shouldn't kept pushing when it wasn't ready. But,
I think that's a very common mistake. And, you know, I've certainly done that in the past myself, has submitted things way too early. And I think particularly, you know, in the earlier days when you don't have the experience and don't have the understanding of the industry, I think a lot of us have done the same thing. Yeah. So did you have some beta readers before you actually published it yourself?
Yeah, I did, absolutely. Once I decided, okay, I'm going to self-publish this thing, I got in there and I got a few objective readers. I got a professional editor to get involved with me and she upset me very much. There was one chapter, she goes, this is terrible, you've got to take this chapter out. And I was absolutely adamant she didn't know what she was talking about until I ripped it out.
I love it. Yeah, they're usually right, aren't they?
Yes.
And so how was the whole sort of next learning curve, which would have been the how to self-publish learning curve for you?
Self-publishing was really interesting. I had probably an easy route because I wanted to do it properly, for want of a better term, and I went through writing New South Wales and they had a course with Joel Newman. It was fun. It was really, really good because it really, I'm sure if it's published traditionally, it still feels like your baby. When you've done the whole lot and, you know, it's handed to you or the books come in the box in the mail and you're like, I did this.
Yeah. It's a great sense of accomplishment for sure.
Yeah, it was.
So you said you have given it to a few of your tennis sort of friends and colleagues. So what's the general reaction been like from some of them? Were they worried that they were going to feature in the story or?
Oh, they were all terrified they're going to be in the story. One colleague in particular, former colleague in particular, said, I think I'm in it. And I said, just because I called someone an asshole doesn't mean it's you. You were sure someone said to him, you're in it.
That's beautiful.
And he wasn't. He thought that was good. He was sort of a bit chuffed. I think he wanted to be the asshole. But no, there were a lot of people who were nervous because there have been some books that were, there's been a couple of books that were tell-all sort of things, very veiled, that it was, you couldn't not sue because it was so obvious that who they were defaming, which my book is not at all, never was my intention because I love tennis.
And you had planned a launch for January. Was that correct, Sally?
We did a little bit in January down at the Australian Open. As I said, I was getting it into more about getting it into people's hands. Then I did a little bit on Australian Open TV and spoke to a few people, for journos there. I was setting a whole lot of stuff up for Wimbledon, which we were planning to go and, do the big song and dance.
Right.
Of course, Wimbledon did not happen.
No, correct.
Very, very, very long time. Yeah. So, there's a lot of people who've had a lot worse happen to them, so I'm not going to be, poor me. But, it was frustrating, but what can you do? You just have to move forward. And certainly I've been using social media and I've been talking to people in tennis to try and get those people to talk to other people in tennis. But you can imagine that the people in tennis are a little bit preoccupied with finding something to do with their lives because a lot of them are contractors. A lot.
Yeah.
Are in tennis, as with many other things, are contractors. So they're trying to find a way to eke out a living in a lot of cases, and the players are trying to do the same thing.
And you said you're working on another book, Sally. Is that related to the first or a completely separate sort of thing?
Completely separate. I mean, it's got a tennis hook to it, but it's a thriller, murder mystery.
Wow.
One of Australia's youngest wonderful champions wakes up 3 days before the Australian Open in a hotel and looks to the side of the bed and his girlfriend's lying in a bleeding stupor, dying. Well, could be dying, but she certainly isn't conscious. And it's basically what happens from there.
Okay. Ooh, it does sound like a real hook.
Did it? What happened? What are the consequences?
Yeah. Wow. Well, it sounds like you're really enjoying the whole sort of thing, the writing, the publishing, and well on your way in your next book, which is fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's lots of fun. Lots of fun indeed.
Yep. And where can people find Not Quite 30 Love, Sally, if they're interested in reading it?
Absolutely. Well, it's on Amazon. It's on all the, Apple store, the Kindle store, etc. If you go into your bookstore, they'll do it for you, of course. If you're in the Blue Mountains, they already have them, as you can imagine.
Great. Yeah.
You can go to my website, notquite30love.com, and you can order books via that mechanism, whether you want print or whatever. And if you do want, wherever you are, you do want print on demand, pretty much any online bookstore will do that as well. So if you go to Booktopia and search Not Quite 30 Love, you can get a print on demand as well.
And before we let you go, what are you reading at the moment? Have you got a reading recommendation?
Yes, absolutely. I'm reading The Silk House at the moment.
Yes, Kate.
Kate, yep, absolutely. And I'm looking forward to reading The Dictionary of Lost Words. That's my next book in the list.
Well, thank you so much for chatting, Sally, and good luck with the book and with the next one.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to The Book Launch and supporting our authors. If you like what you hear, check us out at rightsforwomen.com, where you can find all our regular episodes and our new book launch episodes, and help us help authors by supporting us at Patreon for just a few dollars each month. You can find out more about all of this on our website.
And don't forget to subscribe to Rights for Women wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, can you please give us a quick rating and review so other people can find us and these awesome books that authors are launching in isolation right now?
Happy reading.
This podcast episode was recorded, produced, and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.